Lev, and never once looking at him, hugs him awkwardly, then leaves the room. His father doesn't look at him either, not at first anyway. He just looks to Marcus, watching his chest rise and fall in a slow, steady, machine-regulated rhythm.
How is he?
Lev asks.
He's in an induced coma. They said they'll keep him like this for 3 days, so the nanos can speed the healing.
Lev has heard that the pain of nano-healing is unbearable. It's best that Marcus sleeps through it. Lev is certain that his parents gave Marcus all tithed organs, the most expensive. He knows this, but he won't ask. Finally, his father looks at him.
Are you satisfied now? Are you happy with the result of your actions?
Lev has imagined this conversation between him and his father 100 times. In each of those mental confrontations, Lev has always been the one making accusations, not the other way around. How dare he? How dare he? Lev wants to lash out, but he refuses to take the bait. He says nothing.
Do you have any idea what you put this family through?
His father says.
The shame? The ridicule?
Lev can't maintain his silence.
Then maybe you shouldn't surround yourself with people as judgmental as you.
His father looks to Marcus again.
Your brother will come home with us,
he decrees, and since any guts that Marcus now has have been paid for by their father's money, he won't have much of a choice.
And me?
Again, his father won't look at him.
My son was tithed a year ago,
he says.
That's the son I choose to remember. As for you, you can do as you please. It's not my concern.
And he says no more.
When Marcus wakes up, tell him I forgive him,
Lev says.
Forgive him for what?
He'll know.
And Lev leaves without saying goodbye. Farther down the hallway, he spots his mother again and other members of his family in the 4th floor waiting room. A brother, 2 sisters, and their husbands. In the end, they came for Marcus. None of them are there for him. He hesitates, wondering if he should go in there. Will they behave like his father, bitter, rigid, and cold, or like his mother, offering a pained hug, yet refusing to look at him? Then, in that moment of indecision, he sees one of his sisters bend down and pick up a baby. It's a new nephew Lev never even knew he had. And the baby is dressed all in white. Lev races back to his room, but even before he gets there, he feels the eruption begin. It starts deep in his gut, sobs rising with such unexpected fury, his abdomen locks in a cramp. He must struggle the last few feet to his room, doubled over, barely able to catch his breath as the tears burst from his eyes. Somewhere, deep, deep down, in the most irrational corner of Lev's mind, perhaps the place where childhood dreams go, he held out a secret hope that he might actually be taken back, that he might one day be welcomed home. Marcus had told him to forget about it, that it would never happen. But nothing could wipe out that stubborn hope that hid within him. Until today. He climbs into his hospital bed and forces his face into the pillow as the sobs crescendo into wails. A full year's worth of suppressed heartache pours forth from his soul like Niagara, and he doesn't care if he drowns in the killing whiteness of its churning waters. Lev wakes without ever remembering having slept. He knows he must have, because there's morning light streaming into the room.
Good morning, Lev.
He turns his head toward the voice a little too sharply, and the room spins around him, an after-effect of the explosion. His ears are still ringing, but at least the flutter in his left ear has settled down. Sitting in a chair near the foot of his bed is a woman a little too well-dressed to be part of the hospital staff.
Are you FBI? Homeland Security? Are you here to ask me more questions because I don't have any more answers?
The woman chuckles slightly.
I'm not with any government agency. I represent the Kavanaugh Trust. Have you heard of it?
Lev shakes his head.
Should I have?
She hands him a colorful brochure, and as he looks at it, he gets a shiver.
Oh, it looks like a harvest camp brochure.
Hardly,
she says, clearly insulted. The right response, as far as Lev is concerned. To put it simply, she tells him, the Kavanaugh Trust is a whole lot of money, set aside by what was once a very wealthy family to help wayward youth, and we can think of few youth as wayward as you. She gives him a twisted little smile, thinking herself funny. She's not. Be that as it may, she says, we understand you have no place to go once you're released, and rather than leave you at the mercy of Child Protective Services, who certainly cannot protect you from any future clapper attacks, we are prepared to offer you a place to live, with the full approval of the juvenile authority, of course, in exchange for your services.
Lev pulls his knees up beneath his covers and shrinks away from her. He doesn't trust well-dressed people who make offers with strings attached.
What kind of services?
She smiles at him warmly.
Just your presence, Mr. Calder. Your presence and your winning personality.
And although he can't think of anything that his personality has won, he says,
sure, why not?
Because he realizes he has absolutely nothing left to lose. He thinks back to the days after he left Sci-Fi and before he arrived at the graveyard. Dark days, to be sure, but punctuated by a bit of light when he found himself on a reservation, taken in by people of chance. The chance folk had taught him that when you have nothing to lose, there's no such thing as a bad roll of the dice. And then something occurs to him, something that has been in the back of his mind for a while, but today has risen to the forefront.
One thing, though, Lev says.
Yes?
I want to have my last name legally changed. Can you do that?
She raises her eyebrows.
Of course, if that's what you want. May I ask what you would like to change it to?
It doesn't matter,
he tells her,
just as long as it's not Calder.
22. Trust. There's a home on a street in northern Detroit. It is now the official legal residence of one Levi Jedediah Garrity. It's a small home, but adequate, and comes through the generosity of the Kavanaugh Trust, dedicated to helping wayward youth. There is a full-time valet to take care of Lev's needs, and a new tutor to take care of his lessons. The trust has even planted a permanent rent-a-cop out front to deter any unwanted guests and suspicious solicitors. No clappers are getting anywhere near the front door here. It would be a perfect situation for Lev, except for the fact that he doesn't actually live there. True, there's that subcutaneous tracking chip embedded in his neck that swears he does, but the chip was easily compromised. Now the chip can ping out a signal from wherever they want Lev to appear to be. No one knows he's being brought to the Kavanaugh Mansion, almost 40 miles away. The Kavanaugh Mansion is a behemoth of a building, resting on 75 secluded acres in Lake Orion, Michigan. It was designed to look like Versailles, and was built with motor money in the days before the American automotive industry had done its own version of clapping and applauded itself into non-existence. Most people don't know the mansion is still there. They're mostly right, because it's barely there at all. Exposure to the elements all these years has left it one storm short of surrender. The mansion served as the Midwest headquarters for the Choice Brigade during the Heartland War, until it was captured and became headquarters for the Life Army. Apparently, both the lifers and choicers saw great value in having their own personal Versailles. The place was under attack constantly until the day the Unwind Accord ended all battles, putting forth the worst possible compromise, and yet the only one both sides could agree to. Sanctity of life from conception to 13, with the option of unwinding teenagers whose lives were deemed to have been a mistake. For many years after the war, the Kavanaugh Mansion lay crumbling, too expensive to repair, yet too large to tear down. Until Charles Kavanaugh Jr., to assuage his guilt at still having old money in new times, donated the mansion to a trust fund, which was owned by another trust fund, which was laundered through yet another trust fund, which was owned by the Anti-Divisional Resistance. 23. Lev.
Charles Cavanaugh Jr. meets Lev personally at the entrance of the crumbling mansion. He's dressed like he's too rich to worry about how he's dressed. Even with the Cavanaugh family fortune long gone, Lev figures there must be enough residual wealth to keep at least his generation living elite. The only thing that betrays his allegiance to the resistance is his thinning hair. Nowadays, the rich don't have thinning hair. If they do, they just replace it with someone else's.
Lev! It's an honor to meet you!
He grasps Lev's hand with both of his, shaking it firmly and maintaining a steady eye contact that Lev finds awkward.
Thanks. Same here.
Lev isn't sure what else to say.
I was so sorry to hear about the loss of your friend and your brother's injuries. I can't help but think if we had approached you earlier, the tragedy never would have happened.
Lev looks up at the mansion. Barely a window is intact. Birds fly through the jagged, broken panes.
Don't let it fool you,
Cavanaugh says.
She still has some life in her, and the way she appears is actually an asset. It's camouflage for anyone who tries to look too closely.
Lev can't imagine anyone looking too closely. The place is on 75 fenced-in acres, in the middle of a weedy field that was once a lawn, which is surrounded on all sides by dense woods. The only way to even see the mansion would be from above. Cavanaugh pushes open a rotted door and leads Lev into what was once a grand foyer. Now the foyer has no roof. Two sets of stairs climb to the second floor, but most of the wood on the stairs is caved in, and weeds grow through cracks in the floor, pushing up the marble tiles, making it randomly uneven.
This way!
Cavanaugh leads him deeper into the ruined building, down a dim hallway, in equally awful condition. The smell of mildew makes the air feel gelatinous. Lev is about to conclude that Cavanaugh is a madman and run in the other direction, when the man unlocks a heavy door in front of them, swinging it open to reveal a grand dining hall.
We've restored the north wing. For now, it's all we need. Of course, we've had to board all the windows. Lights at night in an abandoned ruin would be way too conspicuous.
The place is nowhere near in the condition it must have once been in. There's still peeling paint and water stains on the roof, but it's far more livable than the rest of the sprawling estate. The dining hall has two mismatched chandeliers that were probably salvaged from other areas of the mansion. Three long tables and benches suggest that a lot of people are served their meals here. At the far end of the room is a huge fireplace, and above it a full-length portrait, larger than life. At first, Lev takes it to be a painting of one of the Cavanaughs as a boy, until he looks more closely.
Wait, is that me?
Cavanaugh smiles.
A good likeness, isn't it?
As he crosses toward it, Lev can see how good a likeness it really is, or at least a fine rendering of how he looked a year ago. In the portrait, he's wearing a yellow shirt that seems to glow like gold. In fact, the portrait is painted so that his skin gives off a sort of divine radiance. The expression on his painted face speaks of wisdom and peace, the kind of peace Lev has yet to find in life. And at the base of the portrait are tithing whites metaphorically trampled beneath his feet. His first reaction is to laugh.
What's this all about?
It's about the cause you fight for, Lev. I'm pleased to say we've picked up where you left off.
On the mantel, just below the portrait, are everything from flowers to handwritten notes to bits of jewelry and other trinkets.
These things spontaneously began to appear after we put up the portrait,
Cavanaugh explains.
We didn't expect it, but maybe we should have.
Lev still struggles to process this. Again, all he can do is giggle.
You're joking, right?
Then off to his right, at a doorway to an adjacent hallway, a woman calls out to them.
Mr. Cavanaugh, the natives are getting restless. Can I let them in?
Lev can see kids craning to see around the rather heavy-set woman.
Give us a moment, please,
Cavanaugh tells her, then smiles at Lev.
As you can imagine, they're very excited to meet you.
Who?
The tithes, of course. We held a contest, and 7 were chosen to personally greet you.
Kavanaugh talks like these are all things Lev should already know. It's all too much for him to wrap his mind around.
Tithes?
Ex-tithes, actually. Rescued before their arrival at their respective harvest camps.
Then something clicks, and it dawns on Lev how this is possible.
Parts pirates. The ones who target tithes.
Oh, there are certainly parts pirates,
Kavanaugh says.
But to the best of my knowledge, none of them have taken any tithes. It's a good cover story, though. Keeps the juvenile authority barking up the wrong tree.
The idea that tithes are being rescued rather than sold on the black market is something that has never occurred to Lev.
Are you ready to meet our little squad of ambassadors?
Sure. Why not? Kavanaugh signals the woman to let them in, and they enter in an orderly procession that doesn't hide the high-voltage excitement in their step. They're all dressed in bright colors, intentionally so. Not a bit of white in the whole bunch. Lev just stands there dazed as they greet him one by one. A couple of them just stare and nod their heads, too starstruck to say anything. Another shakes his hand so forcefully Lev's shoulder has to absorb the shock. One boy is so nervous he stumbles and nearly falls at Lev's feet, then goes beet red as he steps away.
"Your hair is different,"
one girl says, then panics like she's gravely insulted him.
"But it's good. I like it. I like it long."
"I know everything about you,"
another kid announces.
"Seriously, ask me anything."
And although Lev is a bit creeped out by the thought, he says,
"Okay, what's my favorite ice cream?"
"Jerry Garcia,"
the kid says without the slightest hesitation. The answer is, of course, correct. Lev's not quite sure how to feel about it.
"So, you were all tithes?"
"Yes,"
says a girl in bright green.
"Until we were rescued. We know how wrong tithing is now."
"Yeah," says another.
"We learned to see the way you see."
Lev finds himself giddy and caught up in their adoration. Not since his days as a tithe has he felt golden. After Happy Jack, everyone saw him either as a victim to be pitied or a monster to be punished. But these kids revere him as a hero. He can't deny that after all he's been through, it feels good. Really good. A girl in screaming violet can't contain herself and throws her arms around him.
"I love you, Lev Calder,"
she cries. One of the other kids pulls her off.
"Sorry, she's a little intense."
"It's okay," Lev says. "But my name's not Calder anymore. It's Garrity."
"After Pastor Daniel Garrity,"
the know-it-all kid blurts.
"The one who died in the clapper blast 2 weeks ago."
The kid is so proud that he has all the information down, he doesn't realize how raw Dan's death still is for Lev.
"How's your broken eardrum, by the way?"
"Getting better."
Kavanaugh, who has been standing back, now steps in to gather them and send them on their way.
"That's enough for now," he tells them. "But you all get your chance to have a personal audience with Lev."
"Audience?" Lev says, chuckling at the thought.
"Who am I, the Pope?"
But no one else is laughing, and it occurs to him that his inside joke with Pastor Dan has actually become a reality. All these kids are Leviathan. 64. That's how many ex-tithes are being sheltered and given sanctuary in the Kavanaugh Mansion. It gives Lev a hope he hasn't felt since the passage of the Cap 17 law, which turned out to be as many steps backward as it was forward.
"Eventually we'll give them new identities and place them with families we trust to keep their secret,"
Kavanaugh tells Lev.
"We call it the Wholeness Relocation Program."
Kavanaugh gives Lev the grand tour of the reclaimed North Wing. On the walls are framed photos and news clippings about Lev. A banner in one hallway proclaims they should all live like Lev. His giddiness begins to turn to butterflies in his stomach. How can he live up to all this build-up? Should he even try?
"Don't you think it's kind of overkill?"
he asks Kavanaugh.
We've come to realize that by pulling these kids from their tithing, we've removed from them the focus of their lives, the one immutable thing they believed in. We needed to fill that space, at least temporarily. You were the natural candidate.
Stenciled on the walls are quotes and expressions attributed to Lev. Things like, "To celebrate an undivided life is the finest goal of all," and "Your future is wholly yours." They are sentiments he agrees with, but they never came out of his mouth.
"It must feel strange to be the focus of such lofty attention," Kavanaugh says to him. "I hope you approve of how we've used your image to help these children."
Lev finds himself in no position to approve or disapprove, or even to judge the wisdom of it. How do you judge the brightness of a light when you're the source? A spotlight can never see the shadows it casts. All he can do is go with it, and take his place as some sort of spiritual figure. There are worse things. Having experienced several of them, there is no question that this is better. On his second day there, they begin to arrange his personal audiences with the ex-tithes, just a few a day so as not to overwhelm him. Lev listens to their life stories and tries to give advice, much the same way he did for the incarcerated divisional risk kids he used to visit on Sundays with Pastor Dan. For these kids, though, no matter what Lev says, they take it as divinely inspired. He could say the sky is pink, and they would find some mystical, symbolic meaning to it.
"All they want is validation," Kavanaugh tells him.
"And validation from you? Oh, it's the greatest gift they could hope for."
By the end of the first week, Lev has settled into the rhythm of the place. Meals don't begin until he arrives. He's usually called on to say a non-denominational grace. His mornings are spent in audiences, and in the afternoon, he's allowed time to himself. He's encouraged by Kavanaugh and the staff to write his memoirs, which feels like an absurd request of a 14-year-old, but they're completely serious. Even his bedroom is absurd, a kingly chamber far too large for him, and one of the few that has an actual window to the outside that isn't boarded over. His room is larger than life, his image larger than life and death combined, and yet all these things only serve to make him feel increasingly small. And to make it worse, at each meal he is faced by that portrait, the Lev they believe he is. He can fill that role for sure, but the eyes of that portrait, which follow him through the room, carry an accusation. "You are not me," those eyes say. "You never were. You never will be." But still, flowers and notes and tributes appear on the mantle beneath the painting, and Lev comes to realize that it isn't just a portrait. It's an altar. During his second week, he's called in to greet new arrivals, the first since his own arrival. They're fresh off the hijacked van, and all they know is that they've been kidnapped and tranked. They do not yet know by whom.
"It would be our wish," Kavanaugh tells him, "that you be the first thing they see upon their unveiling."
"Why? So they can imprint on me like ducklings?"
Kavanaugh exhales in mild exasperation.
"Hardly. To the best of their knowledge, you are the only one who escaped being tithed. You don't realize the visceral effect your presence has on another child slated for that same fate."
Lev is directed to the ballroom, which remains in a sorry state and is probably beyond salvation. He is sure there is some researched psychological reason for greeting the kids here, but he doesn't really want to ask. When he gets there, the two new arrivals are already there, a boy and a girl. They've been tied to chairs and blindfolded, making it clear what Kavanaugh means by unveiling. The man is way too theatrical. The boy sobs, and the girl tries to calm him.
"It's all right, Timothy,"
she says.
"Whatever's going on, it's going to be okay."
Lev sits across from them, feeling awkward and frightened by their fear. He knows he needs to put forth confidence and comfort, but facing a pair of terrified kidnap victims is different from facing adoring ex-tithes. Kavanaugh is not present, but two adults in his employ stand at the ready. Lev swallows and tries to keep his hands from shaking by gripping the arms of his chair.
Okay, you can take off their blindfolds.
The boy's eyes are red from crying. The girl is already looking around, surveying the situation.
I'm really sorry we had to do it this way,
Lev says.
We couldn't risk you getting hurt or figuring out where you were being taken. It was the only way to safely rescue you.
Rescue us?
Says the girl.
Is that what you call this?
Lev tries to deflect the accusation in her voice, but can't. He forces himself to hold eye contact the way Kavanaugh does, hoping he can sell it as confidence.
Well, it might not feel that way at the moment, but yeah, that's exactly what we've done.
The girl scowls in absolute defiance, but the boy gasps, and his wet eyes go wide.
You're him! You're that tithe who became a clapper! You're Levi Calder!
Lev offers a slim, apologetic smile, not even bothering to correct the last name.
Yes, but my friends call me Lev.
I'm Timothy!
The boy volunteers.
Timothy Taylor Vance! Her name's I can't quite remember, but it starts with an M, right?
My name is my business and will stay my business,
she says. Lev looks at the little cheat sheet he'd been given.
Your name is Miracolina Roselli. It's a pleasure to meet you, Miracolina. Do you go by Mira?
Her continuing glare makes it clear that she doesn't.
All right, Miracolina then.
What gives you the right?
She says. It's almost a growl. Lev forces eye contact again. She knows who he is, but she hates him, despises him even. He's seen that look before, but it surprises him to see it here.
Maybe you didn't hear me,
Lev says, getting a little bit angry.
We just saved you.
By whose definition of save?
And for an instant, just an instant, he sees himself through this girl's eyes, and he doesn't like what he sees.
I'm glad you're both here,
he says, trying to hide the quaver in his voice.
We'll talk again.
Then he signals for the adults to take the kids away. Lev sits there in the ballroom alone for a good 10 minutes. There is something about Miracolina's behavior that feels disturbingly familiar. He tries to think back to when Connor pulled him from his limo on his own tithing day. Was he that belligerent? That uncooperative? There is so much from that day that he's blocked out. At what point did he begin to realize that Connor wasn't the enemy? He will win her over. He has to. All the ex-tithes have been turned eventually, unbrainwashed, deprogrammed. But what if this girl is the exception? What then? Suddenly, this whole rescue operation, which had felt like a grand and glorious idea, feels very small and very personal. 24. Miracolina. Born to save her brother's life and to be gifted back to God, Miracolina will not stand for this violation, the corruption of her sacred destiny into the profane life of a fugitive. Even her own parents became weak at the end, willing to break their pact with God and save her from her tithing. Would this please them, she wonders, for her to be captured and forced to live whole, denied the holy mystery of the divided state? Not only must she suffer this indignation, but she must suffer it at the hands of the boy she practically considers to be Satan incarnate. Miracolina is not a girl given to hatred and unfair judgment, but to be faced with this boy proves she is not nearly as tolerant as she had thought.
Perhaps that's why I have been put on this path,
she thinks,
to humble me and make me realize that I can be a hater just like anyone else.
On that first day, they try to trick her by putting her in a comfortable bedroom in much better condition than most of the mansion.
You can rest here until the last effects of the tranks wear off,
says a plump, kindly woman, who also brings her a meal of corned beef and cabbage with a tall, heady glass of root beer.
St. Patrick's Day, don't you know,
she says.
Eat up, dearie. There's more if you want seconds.
It's a blatant attempt to win her over. She eats, but refuses to enjoy it. There are videos and books in her room to entertain her, but Miracolina has to laugh, because just as the Harvest Camp van had only happy, family-friendly movies, The titles she has to choose from here have a clear agenda as well. They're all about kids being mistreated, but rising above it, or kids empowering themselves in a world that doesn't understand them. Everything from Dickens to Salinger, as if Miracolina Roselli could possibly have anything in common with Holden Caulfield. There are also drawers filled with clothes in bright colors, all her size, and she shudders to think that they took her measurements and prepared a wardrobe while she was unconscious. Her tithing whites have become dirty, but she won't give them the satisfaction of changing out of them. Finally, a bald, middle-aged man comes in with a clipboard and a name tag that says Bob.
I used to be a respected psychiatrist until I spoke out against unwinding,
Bob tells her after the obligatory introductions.
Being ostracized was a blessing in disguise, though, because it allowed me to come here, where I'm truly needed.
Miracolina keeps her arms folded, giving him nothing. She knows what this is all about. They call it deprogramming, which is a polite term for undoing brainwashing with more brainwashing.
You used to be respected, which means you're not anymore,
she tells him.
And I don't have respect for you either.
After a brief psych evaluation, which he refuses to take seriously, Bob sighs and clicks his pen closed.
I think you'll find, he says, that our concern for you is genuine, and we want you to truly blossom.
I'm not a potted plant,
she tells him, and hurls her glass of flat root beer at the door as it closes behind him. She quickly discovers that her door is not locked. Another trick. She goes out to explore the halls of the mansion. She can't deny that even in her anger at having been abducted, she's curious about what goes on here. How many other kids have been torn from their tithing? How many captors are there? What are her chances of escape? It turns out there are tons of other kids. They hang out in dorm rooms or public areas. They work to repair the unrepairable damage and rot around the mansion, and they have classes taught by other Bob-like people. She wanders into a social area with a sagging floor and a pool table propped up with wood to keep it level. One girl glances at her, singling her out, and approaches. Her name tag says Jackie.
You must be Miracolina,
Jackie says, grabbing her hand to shake, since Miracolina won't extend it.
I know it's a tough adjustment, but I think we're going to be great friends.
Jackie has the look of a tithe, as do all the other kids here, a certain cleanness and elevation above worldly things. Even though no one wears a stitch of white, they can't hide what they once were.
Are you assigned to me?
Miracolina asks. Jackie shrugs apologetically.
Yeah, kind of. Thanks for being honest, but I don't like you, and I don't want to be your friend.
Jackie, who is not a formally respected psychiatrist, but just an ordinary 13-year-old girl, is clearly hurt by her words, and Miracolina immediately regrets them. She must not allow herself to become callous and jaded. She must rise above this.
I'm sorry. It's not you I don't like. It's what they're making you do. If you want to be my friend, try again. When I'm not your assignment.
Okay, fair enough,
Jackie says.
But friends or not, I'm supposed to help you get with the program, whether you like it or not.
An understanding reached, Jackie returns to her friends but keeps an eye on Miracolina as long as she's in the room. Timothy, the boy she was kidnapped with, is in the room as well, with a former tithe who was apparently assigned to him. The two talk like they're already great friends. Clearly, Timothy has gotten with the program, and since he was not too keen on being unwound anyway, all it took to deprogram him was a change of clothes.
How could you be so shallow?
She says to him when she catches him alone later in the day.
If that's what you want to call it,
he says, all smiles, like he's just been given a new puppy.
But if it's shallow to want a life, then heck, I'm a wading pool.
Deprogramming. It's enough to make her sick. She despises Timothy and wonders how anyone's lifelong faith could be traded for corned beef and cabbage. Jackie seeks her out later in the day, after Miracolina has determined that her freedom ends at a locked door, which keeps all the ex-tithes in a single wing of the mansion.
The rest is still uninhabitable,
Jackie tells her.
That's why we're only allowed in the North Wing.
Jackie explains that their days are spent in classes designed to help them to adjust.
What happens to the kids who fail?
Miracolina asks with a smirk. Jackie says nothing, just looks at her like it's a concept she hasn't considered. Within a few days, Miracolina has all she can stand of the classes. The mornings begin with a long emotional group therapy, where at least one person bursts into tears and is applauded by the others for doing so. Miracolina usually says nothing, because defending tithing is frowned on by the faculty.
You have a right to your opinion,
they all say if she ever speaks out against their deprogramming.
But we're hoping you will eventually see otherwise.
Which means she really doesn't have a right to an opinion. There's a class in modern history, something few schools actually teach. It includes the Heartland War, the Unwind Accord, and everything surrounding them, right up to the current day. There are discussions about the splinter groups within many major religions that took upon themselves the act of human tithing, becoming socially sanctioned tithing cults.
These weren't grassroots movements, the teacher tells them. It began with wealthy families, executives and stockholders in major corporations, as a way of setting an example for the masses, because if even the rich approve of unwinding, then everyone should. The tithing cults were part of a calculated plan to root unwinding in the national psyche.
Miracolina can't keep herself from raising her hand.
Excuse me,
she tells the instructor.
But I'm Catholic and don't belong to a tithing cult, so how do you account for me?
She thought the teacher might say, you're the exception that proves the rule, or something equally insipid, but she doesn't. Instead, she only says,
that's interesting. I bet Lev would love to talk to you about that.
To Miracolina, that's the worst threat the teacher could make, and she knows it. It keeps Miracolina quiet. Even so, her resistance to the resistance is well known in the mansion, and she is called in for an unwanted audience with the boy who didn't detonate. It happens on Monday morning. She's pulled out of her intolerable therapy group and taken to a section of the mansion she hasn't seen before, escorted by not one but two resistance workers. Although she can't be sure, she suspects at least one of them is armed. They take her to a plant-filled arboretum, all curved glass and sunshine, kept heated and restored to its former glory. In the center is a mahogany table and two chairs. He's already there, sitting in one of the chairs, the boy at the center of this bizarre hero worship. She sits across from him and waits for him to speak first. Even before he speaks, she can tell he's genuinely interested in her. The only square peg in the whole mansion who can't be whittled round.
So, what's up with you?
He says after studying her for a few moments. She's offended by the informality of the question, as if her whole stance on everything occurring in this place is a matter of something being up. Well, today she'll make it clear to him that her defiance is more than just attitude.
Are you actually interested in me, Clapper? Or am I just the bug you can't squash beneath your iron boot?
He laughs at that.
Iron boot. That's a good one.
He lifts his foot to show her the sole of his Nike.
I'll admit there may be some stomp spiders between the treads, but that's about it. If you're going to give me the third degree,
she tells him,
let's get it over with. Best to withhold food or water. Water is probably best. I'll get thirsty before I get hungry.
He shakes his head in disbelief.
Do you really think I'm like that? Why would you think that? I was taken by force, and you're keeping me here against my will,
she says, leaning across the table toward him. She considers spitting in his face, but decides to save that gesture as punctuation for a more appropriate moment.
Imprisonment is still imprisonment, no matter how many layers of cotton you wrap it in.
That makes him lean farther away, and she knows she's pushed a button. She remembers seeing those pictures of him back when he was all over the news, wrapped in cotton and kept in a bomb-proof cell.
I really don't get you,
he says, a bit of anger in his voice this time.
We saved your life. You could at least be a little grateful. You have robbed me and everyone here of their purpose. That's not salvation. That's damnation. I'm sorry you feel that way.
Now it's her turn to get angry.
Yes, you're sorry I feel that way. Everyone's sorry I feel that way. Are you going to keep this up until I don't feel that way anymore?
He stands up suddenly, pushing his chair back, and paces, fern leaves brushing his clothes. She knows she's gotten to him. He seems like he's about to storm out, but instead takes a deep breath and turns back to her.
I know what you're going through,
he says.
I was brainwashed by my family to actually want to be unwound. And not just by my family, but by my friends, my church, everyone I looked up to. The only voice who spoke sense was my brother Marcus, but I was too blind to hear him until the day I got kidnapped.
You mean see?
She says, putting a nice speed bump in his way. Huh?
Too blind to see him? Too deaf to hear him? Get your senses straight, or maybe you can't because you're senseless.
He smiles. You're good.
And anyway, I don't need to hear your life story. I already know it. You got caught in a freeway pileup, and the Akron AWOL used you as a human shield. Very noble. Then he turned you, like cheese gone bad.
He didn't turn me. I was getting away from my tithing and seeing unwinding for what it is. That's what turned me.
Because being a murderer is better than being a tithe? Isn't that right, Clapper?
He sits back down again, calmer, and it frustrates her that he is becoming immune to her snipes.
When you live a life without questions, you're unprepared for the questions when they come, he says. You get angry, and you totally lack the skills to deal with the anger. So yes, I became a clapper, but only because I was too innocent to know how guilty I was becoming.
There is an intensity about him now, and a moistness to his eyes. Miracolina can tell that he is sincere, and that this is not just a show for her. Maybe he's even saying more than he meant to say. She begins to wonder if she has misjudged him, and then gets angry at herself for wondering such a thing.
You think I'm like you, but I'm not,
Miracolina says.
I'm not part of a religious order that tithes. My parents did it in spite of our beliefs, not because of it.
But you were still raised to believe it was your purpose, weren't you?
My purpose was to save my brother's life by being a marrow donor, so my purpose was served before I was 6 months old.
And doesn't that make you angry that the only reason you're here was to help someone else?
Not at all,
she says a little too quickly. She purses her lips and leans back in her chair, squirming a bit. The chair feels a little too hard beneath her.
All right, so maybe I do feel angry once in a while, but I understand why they did it. If I were them, I would have done the same thing.
Agreed, he says. But once your purpose was served, shouldn't your life be your own?
Miracles are the property of God,
she answers.
No, he says. Miracles are gifts from God. To call them his property insults the spirit in which they're given.
She opens her mouth to reply, but finds she has no response. Because he's right. Damn him for being right. Nothing about him should be right.
We'll talk again when you're over yourself,
he says, and signals a waiting guard to take her away. The next day, a class is added into her schedule to keep her from having too idle a mind. It's called Creative Projection. It takes place in a classroom that was once some kind of parlor, with faded, moth-eaten portraits on peeling walls. Miracolina wonders if the stodgy faces in the paintings look down on the lessons here with approval, disapproval, or absolute indifference.
I want you to write a story,
says the teacher, a man with annoying little round glasses. Glasses, objects of antiquity no longer needed by anyone, what with laser procedures and affordable eye replacement surgery. There is a certain arrogance to their quaintness, as if people who choose to wear glasses feel they are somehow superior.
I want you to write the story of you. Your biography. Not the life you've lived, but the life you're going to live. This is the biography you might write 40, 50 years from now.
The teacher wanders the room, gesticulating into the air, probably imagining himself to be Plato or someone equally lofty.
Project yourselves forward. Tell me who you think you'll be. I know that'll be hard for all of you. You've never dared think of the future, but now you can. I want you to enjoy this. Be as wild as you want. Have fun with it.
Then he sits down and leans back in his chair with his hands behind his head, very satisfied with himself. Miracolina taps her pen impatiently on the page while the other kids write. He wants her dream future? Fine. She'll give these people something honest, even if it isn't what they want to hear.
"It is years from now,"
she writes,
"and my hands belong to a mother who lost her hands in a fire. She has 4 children. She comforts them, bathes them, brushes their hair, and changes their diapers with those hands. She treasures my hands because she knows how precious they are. She gets manicures weekly for me, even though she doesn't know who I was. My legs belong to a girl who was in a plane crash. She had been a track star, but found that my legs simply weren't built for that. For a while she mourned the loss of her Olympic dream, but then realized that my legs could dance. She learned to tango, and one day she met a prince while dancing in Monaco, and she danced her way into his heart. They married, and now the royal couple have a grand ball every year. The highlight of the ball is her stunning tango with her prince."
With every word she writes, Miracolina is filled with deeper fury at all the possibilities stolen from her.
"My heart went to a scientist on the verge of discovering a way to harness starlight and solve the world's energy needs. He was so close, but then suffered a major heart attack. Thanks to me, though, he survived and completed his life's work, making the world a better place for all of us. He even won the Nobel Prize."
Is it so strange to want to give of yourself totally and completely? If that is what's in Miracolina's heart, why should it be denied her?
"And as for my mind, my memories, which are full of a loving childhood, they all went to troubled souls who had no such memories of their own. But now, with that part of me in them, they are healed of the many hurts in their lives."
Miracolina turns in her paper, and the teacher, perhaps more curious about hers than anyone else's, reads it while the other kids are still writing. She watches his face, full of thoughtful expressions as he reads. She doesn't know why she should care, but she's always cared what her teachers think, even the ones she didn't like. Then, when he's done, he comes over to her.
"Very interesting, Miracolina, but you've left out one thing."
"What?"
"Your soul,"
he says.
"Who gets your soul?"
"My soul,"
she tells him with confidence,
"goes to God."
"Hmm."
He strokes some graying whisker stubble.
"So it goes to God, even if every part of your body is still alive?"
Miracolina stands firm against his questioning.
"I have a right to believe that if I want to."
"True, true. One problem with that, though. You're Catholic, isn't that right?"
"Yes."
"And you want to be unwound voluntarily."
"So?"
"Well, if your soul leaves this world, then voluntary unwinding is no different from assisted suicide. And in the Catholic religion, suicide is a mortal sin, which means that by your own beliefs, you'd be going to hell."
Then he leaves her to stew with an A- on her essay. Minus, she assumes, due to the eternal damnation of her soul. 25. Lev. Miracolina has no idea how deeply her obstinance affects him. Most kids here are either terrified of Lev, or worship him, or both. But Miracolina is neither intimidated nor reverent. She just hates him, plain and simple. It shouldn't bother him. He's gotten used to being hated, for just as his brother Marcus said, as much as the public mourned for poor, corrupted little boy Lev, they also despised the monster that he has become. Well, he was innocent, and he was a monster. But here in the Kavanaugh mansion, none of that matters, because here he is one step short of being a god. There's a heady, awkward kind of fun to that, but Miracolina is the pin that pops the bubble. His next encounter with her is the following week, at an Easter dance. Tithes are notoriously inept when it comes to male-female interaction. Knowing that dating and all that goes with it won't be a part of their limited future, tithes and their families don't give boy-girl stuff much attention. In fact, it's downplayed, since it would create the kind of wistful longing that a tithe should not have.
"These kids are all smart as a whip,"
Kavanaugh exclaims at the weekly meeting of the tithe rescue staff.
But they have the social skills of six-year-olds.
It's a fair description of how Lev was on his tithing day as well, and he's not all that sure he's come much further. He's still never been on a date. There are about 20 staff members, and Lev is the only one under 30. Each of their faces are filled with concern that so long-lived it seems burned into their expressions. He wonders if their passion comes from their own experiences with unwinding. Did they, like the Admiral, unwind their own child and come to regret the decision? Was it personal for them, or did their dedication to the cause come from a general disgust with society's status quo?
"We shall have an Easter dance,"
Kavanaugh proclaims from the head of the meeting table,
"and encourage our ex-tithes to behave like normal teenagers. Within reason, of course."
Then he singles Lev out.
"Lev, can we count on you as our goodwill ambassador to join in the festivities?"
Everyone waits for his answer. It bothers him that they're hanging on his response.
"What if I say no?"
Kavanaugh looks at him incredulously.
"Why on earth would you? Everyone loves a party."
"Not really," Lev points out. "The last parties these kids had were their tithing parties. Do you really want to remind them of that?"
The others around the table mumble to one another, weighing what Lev has said, until Kavanaugh dismisses it.
"Tithing parties are farewells," he says. "Ours will be about new beginnings. I'm counting on you to attend."
Lev sighs. "Sure." There is no challenging of ideas in the Kavanaugh mansion when those ideas come from the man who shares the mansion's name. It is decided that the ballroom is in too poor shape for an adolescent gala, so they use the dining hall, clearing away the tables and chairs and setting up a DJ station beneath the portrait. With attendance mandatory, the entire population of ex-tithes is there. As Lev expected, they gather by gender on either side of the room like it's a game of dodgeball, boys against girls. Everyone busies themselves drinking punch and eating cocktail weenies, while stealing secret glances at the opposing team, as if being caught looking will get them disqualified. One of the adults does his best impersonation of a DJ, and when encouragement doesn't work, he demands that everyone form a circle on the dance floor to do the hokey-pokey. However, 10 seconds into the dance, he suddenly realizes how ill-advised it is for ex-tithes to be putting various body parts in and out. The DJ becomes flustered and tries to skip right to the "you put your whole self in" part, but the kids are so amused by all this that they continue singing and dancing part by part even after the music has stopped. Ironically, it ends up being the perfect icebreaker. And when the dance music starts up again, there are actually kids dancing. Lev is not one of them. He's more than satisfied to be an observer, in spite of the fact that he can have his pick of dance partners. Although he suspects if he actually did ask one of these girls to dance, she might spontaneously combust on the spot. Then, from across the room, he spots Miracolina, leaning back against the wall with her arms resolutely crossed, and he decides that this is a challenge worth taking. The moment she sees him approaching, she looks away, a bit panicked, hoping he's headed toward someone else. Then she takes a visible breath when she realizes she is the subject of his attention.
"So," says Lev, as casually as he can, "you want to dance?"
"Do you believe in the end of the world?"
she responds. Lev shrugs.
"I don't know why."
"Because the day after that is when I'll dance with you."
Lev smiles.
"You're funny. I didn't think you had a sense of humor."
"I'll tell you what. If you run out of girls who worship the ground you walk on, you can ask me again. The answer will still be no, but I'll give you the courtesy of pretending to think about it."
"I read your essay,"
he tells her, which gets a nice head-snapping reaction out of her.
"You have a dancing princess fantasy. Don't deny it."
"My legs have a dancing princess fantasy."
"Well, to dance with your legs, I guess I'll have to put up with the rest of you."
"No, you won't,"
she says,
"because not a single part of me will be here."
Then she glances toward Lev's portrait, which is now weirdly lit by colorful strobe lights.
Why don't you dance with your portrait? Miracolina suggests. The two of you deserve each other.
Then she storms out. The adults at the door try to stop her from going back to her room, but she gets past them anyway. After she's gone, Lev hears the grumbling around him.
She's such a loser,
someone says. Lev turns to the kid with a vengeance. It's Timothy, the boy who arrived with her.
I could say the same about you, he snaps.
All of you! Then he shuts himself up before he goes too far.
No, that's not true, but you shouldn't be judging her.
Yes, Lev,
says Timothy obediently.
I won't, Lev. I'm sorry, Lev.
And then a shy girl, apparently less shy than all the other shy girls, steps forward.
I'll dance with you, Lev.
So he goes out onto the dance floor and obliges her, and every other girl there with a dance, while his portrait looks down on them with its irritating gaze of holy superiority. The next day, the portrait is vandalized. Something rude is tagged in spray paint right across the middle of it. Breakfast is delayed until the portrait can be removed. There is a spray paint can missing from the storeroom, but no smoking gun as to who could have done it. Everyone has a theory, though, and most of those theories point to the same person.
We know it was her,
the other kids try to tell Lev.
Miracolina's the only one here who has something against you.
How do you know she's the only one?
Lev asks them.
She's just the only one with guts enough to say it out loud.
Out of respect for Lev's wishes, the other kids don't accuse her to her face, and the adults are diplomatic enough to keep their opinions to themselves.
Perhaps we need more surveillance cameras,
Kavanaugh suggests.
What we need, Lev tells him, is more freedom to express opinions. Then things like this wouldn't happen.
Kavanaugh is genuinely insulted.
You talk like this is a harvest camp. Everyone's free to express themselves here.
Well, I guess not everyone feels that way.
Twenty-six. Miracolina. After a day of being cold-shouldered by every living thing in the mansion, there's a knock on her door. She doesn't say anything, because whoever it is will just come in anyway. The bedrooms here have no locks. The door opens slowly, and Lev steps in. There's a quickening of her heart when she sees him. She tells herself it's anger.
If you're here to accuse me of vandalizing your portrait, I confess. I can't hide the truth anymore. I did it. Now punish me by taking away all my inspirational movies, please.
Lev just keeps his arms limply by his side.
Stop it. I know you didn't do it.
Oh, so you finally caught the naughty tithe?
Not exactly. I just know it wasn't you.
It's a bit of a relief to be vindicated, although she did take some guilty pleasure in being a prime suspect.
So what do you want?
I've been meaning to apologize for the way you were brought here, tranked and blindfolded and all. I mean, what they're doing here is important, but I don't always agree with how they do it.
Miracolina notes that this is the first time she's heard him say they instead of we.
I've been here for weeks, she says. Why are you telling me this now?
Lev reaches up and flips his hair out of his eyes.
I don't know. It was just bothering me.
So, you're going around apologizing to every kid here?
No, Lev admits. Just you.
Why?
He begins pacing the small room, raising his voice.
Because you're the only one who's still angry. Why are you so angry?
The only angry person in this room is you,
Miracolina says with antagonizing calm.
And there are plenty of angry kids here. Why else would your portrait get vandalized?
Forget about that, shouts Lev.
We're talking about you.
If you don't stop yelling, I'll have to ask you to leave. In fact, I think I'll ask you to leave anyway.
She points to the door.
Leave!
No.
So she picks up a hairbrush and throws it at him. It beams him on the head and ricochets to the wall, where it wedges behind the TV.
Ow!
He grabs his head, grimacing.
That hurt!
Good. It was supposed to.
Lev clenches his fists, growls, then turns like he's going to storm out, but he doesn't. Instead, he turns back to her, unclenching his fists and holding his palms out to her, pleading like maybe he's showing off his stigmata. Well, there might be blood on his hands, but it sure isn't flowing from his palms.
"So is this how it's going to be?" he asks. "You're just going to stew and bitch, make things miserable for everyone here? Don't you want something more out of life?"
"No," she tells him, "because my life ended on my 13th birthday. As far as I'm concerned, from that moment on, I was supposed to be a part of other people's lives."